I know a few of the dudes around the halfway house, but they don't have cars. When you spend your life in prison, Pastor, you don't have a lot of friends on the outside. Where are you, Travis? I told you. I'm in a diner. Hungry. Which one? Blue Moon? You know it. Yes. You order something to eat, I'll be there in 15 minutes. Thank you, Pastor. Keith hung up the phone and sat on the edge of the bed next to his wife. Neither spoke for a few minutes. Neither wanted to fight. Is he drunk? She finally asked. I don't think so. He's had a few but seems sober. I don't know. What are you doing, Keith? I'm buying dinner, or breakfast, or whatever it is. I'll wait for him to change his mind again. If he's serious, then I have no choice but to drive him to Texas. You do have a choice, Keith. You're not being forced to take this pervert to Texas. What about that young man on death row, Dana? Think about Dante Drum's mother right now. This will be her last day to see her son. Boyette's pulling your leg, Keith. He's a liar. Maybe. And maybe not. But look at what's at stake here. At stake? Your job could be at stake. Your reputation, career, everything could be at stake. We have three little boys to think about. I'm not going to jeopardize my career, Dana, or my family. I might get a slap on the wrist, but that's all. I know what I'm doing. Are you sure? No. He quickly shed his pajamas and put on a pair of jeans, sneakers, a shirt, and a red Cardinals baseball cap. She watched him dress without another word. He kissed her on the forehead and left the house. Boyette was inspecting an impressive platter of food when Keith took the chair across from him. The diner was half full, with several tables occupied by uniformed policemen, all eating pie, average weight at least 250. Keith ordered coffee and caught the irony of an unconvicted murderer and parole violator having a hearty meal 30 feet from a small squad of cops. Where have you been all day? Keith asked. The tick. A large bite of scrambled eggs. As he chewed, he said, I really don't remember. We wasted an entire day, Travis. Our plan was to do the video, send it to the authorities and the press in Texas, and hope for a miracle. You ruined that plan by disappearing. The day's done, Pastor. Leave it alone. You taking me to Texas or not? So you're jumping parole. The tick, a sip of coffee, his hand shaking. Everything from his voice to his fingers to his eyes seemed to be engaged in a steady tremor. Parole is the least of my worries right now, Pastor. Dying occupies most of my time. And that boy in Texas concerns me. Tried to forget him, but I can't. And the girl, I need to see her before I die. Why? I need to say I'm sorry. I hurt a lot of people, Pastor, but I only killed one.
He glanced at the policeman, then kept going, his voice a bit lower.
And I don't know why. She was my favorite. I wanted to keep her forever. And when I realized I couldn't, well, I...
Got it, Travis. Let's talk logistics here. Sloan, Texas is 400 miles away, straight shot as the crow flies. But it's more like 550 by car, with a lot of two-lane roads. It's midnight. If we left in the next hour or so and drove like maniacs, we might be there by noon. That's 6 hours before the execution. Any idea what we do when we get there? Boyette chewed on a piece of sausage and pondered the question, completely untouched by any sense of urgency. Keith noticed that he took very small bites, chewed them a long time, laid down his fork, and took a sip of either coffee or water. He did not seem to be overly hungry. Food was not important. After more coffee, Boyette said,
I was thinking that we go to the local television station, and I go on the air, tell my story, take responsibility, tell the idiots down there that they got the wrong guy for the murder, and they'll stop it. Just like that. I don't know, Pastor. I never done this before. You? What's your plan?
At this point, finding the body is more important than your confession. Frankly, Travis, given your lengthy record and the disgusting nature of your crimes, your credibility will be challenged. I've done some research since I met you on Monday morning, and I've run across some anecdotes about the nutcases who pop up around executions and make all sorts of claims.
You calling me a nutcase?
No, I'm not. But I'm sure they'll call you a lot of names in Sloan, Texas. They won't believe you.
Do you believe me, Pastor?
I do.
Would you like some eggs and bacon? You're paying for it.
No thanks. The tick. Another glance at the cops. He pointed both index fingers at both temples and massaged them in tiny circles, grimacing as if he might scream. Pain finally passed. Keith looked at his watch. Boyette began shaking his head slightly and said,
"It'll take longer to find the body, Pastor. Can't be done today."
Since Keith had no experience in such matters, he simply shrugged and said nothing.
"Either we go to Texas, or I walk back to the halfway house and get yelled at. It's your choice, Pastor.
I'm not sure why I'm supposed to make the decision."
"It's very simple. You have the car, the gas, the driver's license. I have nothing but the truth."
The car was a Subaru, four-wheel drive, 185,000 miles on the odometer, and at least 12,000 miles since the last oil change. Dana used it to haul the boys all over Topeka, and it showed the wear and tear of such a life on the streets. Their other car was a Honda Accord with a sticky oil light and a bad set of rear tires. "Sorry for the dirty car," Keith said, almost embarrassed as they crawled in and closed the doors. Boyette said nothing at first. He placed his cane between his legs. "Seat belts are mandatory now," Keith said as he buckled up. Boyette did not move. There was a moment of silence in which Keith realized that the journey had begun. The man was in his car, along for a ride that would consume hours, maybe days, and neither knew where this little journey might take them. Slowly, Boyette strapped himself in as the car began to move. Their elbows were inches apart. Keith got the first whiff of stale beer and said, "So, Travis, what's your history with booze?" Boyette was breathing deeply, as if soothed by the security of the car and its locked doors. Typically, he waited at least 5 seconds before responding.
"Never thought of it as a history. Not a big drinker. I'm 44 years old, Pastor, and I spent just over 23 of those years locked away in various facilities, none of which had saloons, lounges, juke joints, strip clubs, all-night drive-throughs. Can't get a drink in prison."
"You've been drinking today?"
"I had a few bucks. Went to a bar in a hotel and had some beers. They had a television in the bar. I saw a report on the drum execution in Texas. Had a picture of the boy. It hit me hard, Pastor, I gotta tell you. I was feeling pretty mellow, you know. Kinda sentimental anyway. And when I saw that boy's face, I almost got choked up. I drank some more. Watched the clock get closer and closer to 6 p.m. I made the decision to skip parole. Go to Texas. Do what's right."
Keith was holding his cell phone. "I need to call my wife."
"How is she?"
"Fine. Thanks for asking."
"She's so cute."
"You need to forget about her." Keith mumbled a few awkward phrases into the phone and then slapped it shut. He drove quickly through the deserted streets of central Topeka. "So, Travis, we're planning on this long drive down to Texas, where you face the authorities and tell the truth and try to stop this execution. And I'm assuming at some point, very soon, you'll be expected to lead the authorities to Nicole's body. All this, of course, will lead to your arrest and being thrown in jail in Texas. They'll charge you with all sorts of crimes and you'll never get out. Is that the plan, Travis? Are we on the same page?" The tick. The pause. "Yes, Pastor, we're on the same page. It doesn't matter. I'll be dead before they can get me properly indicted by the grand jury."
"I didn't want to say that."
"You don't have to. We know it. But I prefer that nobody in Texas knows about my tumor. It's only fitting that they get the satisfaction of prosecuting me. I deserve it. I'm at peace, Pastor."
"At peace with whom?"
"Myself. After I see Nicole again and tell her I'm sorry, then I'll be ready for anything, including death."
Keith drove on in silence. He was facing a marathon trip with this guy, virtually shoulder to shoulder for the next 10, maybe 12 hours, and he hoped he wouldn't be as crazy as Boyette by the time they arrived in Sloan. He parked in the driveway behind the Accord and said, "Travis, I'm assuming you have no money, no clothes, nothing." This seemed painfully obvious. Travis chuckled, raised his hands and said,
"Here I am, Pastor, with all my worldly assets."
"That's what I thought. Wait here. I'll be back in 5 minutes." Keith left the engine running and hurried into his house. Dana was in the kitchen, throwing together sandwiches and chips and fruit and anything else she could find.
"Where is he?"
she demanded as soon as Keith walked through the door. "In the car. He's not coming in."
"Keith, you can't be serious about this."
"What are the choices, Dana?" He'd made his decision, as unsettling as it was. He was prepared for a nasty fight with his wife, and he was willing to take the risks that his journey might entail. "We can't sit here and do nothing when we know the real killer. He's out there in the car." She wrapped a sandwich and stuffed it into a small box. Keith took a folded grocery bag from the pantry and went into their bedroom. For his new pal Travis, he found an old pair of khakis, a couple of t-shirts, socks, underwear, and a Packers sweatshirt that no one had ever worn. He changed shirts, put on his clerical collar and a navy sport coat, and then packed a few things of his own in a gym bag. Minutes later, he was back in the kitchen where Dana was leaning against the sink, arms locked defiantly across her chest.
"This is a huge mistake," she announced.
"Maybe so. I didn't volunteer for this. Boyette chose us."
"Us?"
"Okay, he chose me. He has no other means of getting to Texas, or so he says. I believe him." She rolled her eyes. Keith glanced at the clock on the microwave. He was anxious to take off, but he also realized that his wife was entitled to a few parting shots.
"How can you believe anything he says?" she demanded.
"We've had this conversation, Dana.
What if you get arrested down there?"
"For what? Trying to stop an execution? I doubt that's a crime, even in Texas."
"You're helping a man jump parole, right?"
"Right, in Kansas. They can't arrest me for it in Texas."
"But you're not sure."
"Look, Dana, I'm not going to get arrested in Texas, I promise. I might get shot, but not arrested."
"Are you trying to be funny?"
"No. No one's laughing."
"Come on, Dana, look at the big picture.
I think Boyette killed this girl in 1998. I think he hid her body and knows where it is. And I think there's a chance for a miracle if we can get down there."
"I think you're crazy."
"Maybe, but I'd rather take a chance."
"Look at the risk, Keith."
He had inched closer and now put his hands on her shoulders. She was rigid, her arms still crossed.
"Look, Dana, I've never taken a chance in my life." "I know, this is your big moment, isn't it?"
"No,
this is not about me.
Once we get there, I'm staying in the shadows, keeping a low profile, dodging bullets, whatever. I'll be in the background. It's the Travis Boyette show. I'm just the driver. Driver? You're a minister with a family. And I'll be back by Saturday. I'll preach on Sunday, and we'll have a picnic that afternoon, I promise. Her shoulders sagged, and her arms fell to her sides. He squeezed her fiercely, and then kissed her. Please try to understand, he said. She nodded gamely and said, Okay. I love you. I love you. Please be careful. Robbie's midnight wake-up call came at 12:30. He'd been in bed with Dee Dee for less than an hour when the phone erupted. Dee Dee, who'd gone to sleep without the aid of alcohol, jumped first and said, Hello? Then she handed the phone to her mate, who was fogged in and trying to open his eyes. Who is it? He growled. Wake up, Robbie, it's Fred. Got some interesting stuff here. Robbie managed to rouse himself, at least to the next level. What is it, Fred? Dee Dee was already flipping to the other side. Robbie smiled at her fine rear end under the satin sheets. Fred said, Had another drink with Joey. Took him to a strip club. Second night in a row, you know. Not sure my liver can take much more of this project. I'm sure his cannot. Anyway, got the boy drunk as a piss ant, and he finally admitted everything. Said he lied about seeing the green van, lied about the black person driving the damn thing, lied about everything. Admitted he was the one who called Kerber with the fake tip about Dante and the girl. It was beautiful. He was crying and carrying on, just a big, blubbering fat boy knocking back beers and talking trash to the strippers. Said he and Dante were once good buddies, back in the 9th and 10th grades when they were football stars. Said he always thought the prosecutors and judges had figured things out. Can't believe it's come down to this. He always thought the execution would never happen. Thought Dante would one day get out of prison. Now he's finally convinced that they're gonna kill him. So he's all tore up about it. Thinks it's his fault. I assured him that it is. The blood will be on his hands. I really beat him up. It was wonderful. Robbie was in the kitchen looking for water. This is great, Fred, he said. It is, and it's not. He refuses to sign an affidavit.
What?
Won't do it. We left the strip club and went to a coffee house. I begged him to sign an affidavit. But it's like talking to a tree.
Why not?
His mama, Robbie. His mama and his family. He can't stomach the idea of admitting that he's a liar. He's got a lot of friends in Sloan and so on. I did everything I could possibly do, but the boy is not willing to sign on. Robbie downed a glass of tap water and wiped his mouth with a sleeve.
Did you tape it?
Of course. I've listened to the tape once, about to go through it again. There's a lot of background noise. You ever been to a strip club? Don't ask. Really loud music. A lot of rap shit and stuff like that. But his voice is there. You can understand what he's saying. We'll need to enhance it. There's no time for that. Okay. What's the plan?
How long is your drive?
Well, at this lovely time of the day, there's no traffic. I can be in Sloan in 5 hours.
Then get your ass on the road.
You got it, boss. An hour later, Robbie was in bed, flat on his back, the dark ceiling doing strange things to his thought process.
Dee Dee was purring like a kitten, dead to the world. He listened to her breathe heavily and wondered how she could be so untroubled by all of his troubles. He envied her. When she awoke hours later, her first priority would be an hour of hot yoga with a few of her dreadful friends. He would be at the office, screaming at the telephone. And so it had all come down to this.
A drunk Joey Gamble confessing his sins and bearing his soul in a strip club to a man with a concealed mic that produced a scratchy audio that no court in the civilized world would take heed of. The fragile life of Dante Drum would depend on the 11th hour recantation by a witness with no credibility. Part 2. The Punishment. Chapter 16. Lost in the frenzy of the departure was the issue of money. When he paid $6 for Boyette's feast at the Blue Moon Diner, Keith realized he was low on cash. Then he forgot about it. He remembered it again after they were on the road and needed gas. They stopped at a truck stop on Interstate 335 at 1:15 a.m. It was Thursday, November 8th. As Keith pumped gas, he was aware of the fact that Dante Drum would be strapped to the gurney in Huntsville in about 17 hours. He was even more aware that the man who should be suffering through his final hours was, instead, sitting peacefully only a few feet away, snug inside the car, his pale, slick head reflecting the overhead fluorescent lights. They were just south of Topeka. Texas was a million miles away. He paid with a credit card and counted $33 in cash in his left front pocket. He cursed himself for not raiding the slush fund he and Dana kept in the kitchen cabinet. The cigar box usually held around $200 in cash. An hour south of Topeka, the speed limit increased to 70 miles per hour, and Keith and the old Subaru inched upward to 75. Boyette so far had been quiet, seemingly content to sit crouched with his hands on his knees and stare at nothing through the right side window. Keith preferred to ignore him. He preferred the silence. Sitting next to a stranger for 12 straight hours was a chore under normal circumstances. Rubbing shoulders with one as violent and weird as Boyette would make for a tense, tedious trip. Just as Keith settled into a quiet, comfortable zone, he was suddenly hit with a wave of drowsiness. His eyelids snapped shut, only to be reopened when he jerked his head. His vision was blurred, foggy. The Subaru edged toward the right shoulder, then he moved back to the left. He pinched his cheeks. He blinked his eyes as wildly as possible. If he'd been alone, he would have slapped himself. Travis did not notice. "How about some music?" Keith said. Anything to jolt his brain. Travis just nodded his approval. "Anything in particular?"
"It's your car."
Yes, it was. His favorite station was classic rock. He cranked up the volume and was soon thumping the steering wheel and tapping his left foot and mouthing the words. The noise cleared his brain, but he was still stunned by how quickly he had almost collapsed. Only 11 hours to go. He thought of Charles Lindbergh and his solo flight to Paris. 33.5 straight hours, with no sleep the night before he took off from New York. Lindbergh later wrote that he was awake for 60 straight hours. Keith's brother was a pilot and loved to tell stories. He thought about his brother, his sister, and his parents, and when he began to nod off, he said, "How many brothers and sisters do you have, Travis?"
"Talk to me, Travis. Anything to keep me awake. You can't help with the driving because you have no license. You have no insurance. You're not touching this wheel, so come on, Travis. Help me out here before we crash."
"I don't know," Travis said after the obligatory period of contemplation. The answer did more to lift the fog than anything by Springsteen or Dylan.
"What do you mean you don't know?"
A slight tick. Travis had now shifted his gaze from the side window to the windshield.
"Well," he said, then paused. "Not long after I was born, my father left my mother. Never saw him again. My mother took up with a man named Daryl, and since he was the first man I ever remembered, I just figured Daryl was my father. My mother told me he was my father. I called him Dad. I had an older brother, and he called him Dad. Daryl was okay. Never beat me or anything, but he had a brother who abused me.
When they took me to court the first time, I think I was 12. I realized that Daryl was not my real father. That really hurt. I was crushed, and Daryl disappeared. The response, like many of Boyette's, raised more mysteries than it solved. It also served to kick Keith's brain into high gear. He was suddenly wide awake. Andy was determined to unravel this psycho. What else was there to do for the next half day? They were in his car. He could ask anything he wanted. So you have one brother.
There's more. My father, the real one, ran off to Florida and took up with another woman. They had a house full of kids, so I guess I have outside brothers and sisters. And there was always this rumor that my mother had given birth to a child before she married my father. You ask how many? Pick a number, Pastor.
How many are you in contact with?
I wouldn't call it contact, but I've written some letters to my brother. He's in Illinois, in prison.
What a surprise. Why is he in prison?
Same reason everybody else is in prison. Drugs and booze. He needed cash for his habits, so he broke into a house. Wrong one. Ended up beating a man.
Does he write back?
Sometimes. He'll never get out.
Was he abused?
No. He was older, and my uncle left him alone, far as I know. We never talked about it.
This was Daryl's brother?
Yeah.
So he wasn't really your uncle?
I thought he was. Why are you asking so many questions, Pastor?
I'm trying to pass the time, Travis. And I'm trying to stay awake. Since I met you Monday morning, I have slept very little. I'm exhausted, and we have a long way to go.
I don't like all these questions.
Well, what exactly do you think you're about to hear in Texas? We show up, you claim to be the real murderer, and then you announce that you really don't like questions. Come on, Travis. Several miles passed without a word. Travis stared to his right at nothing but the darkness, and lightly tapped his cane with his fingertips. He had shown no signs of severe headaches for at least an hour. Keith glanced at the speedometer and realized he was doing 80, 10 over, enough for a ticket anywhere in Kansas. He slowed down and, to keep his mind going, played out the scene in which a state trooper pulled him over, checked his ID, checked Boyette's, then called for backup. A fleeing felon. A wayward Lutheran minister aiding the fleeing felon. Blue lights all over the road. Handcuffs. A night in jail, maybe in the same cell with his friend, a man who wouldn't be the least bit bothered by another night behind bars. What would Keith tell his boys? He began to nod again. There was a phone call he had to make, and there was no good time to make it. The call was guaranteed to engage his mind at such a level that sleep would be forgotten momentarily. He removed his cell phone from his pocket and speed-dialed Matthew Burns. It was almost 2 a.m. Evidently, Matthew was a sound sleeper. It took 8 rings to rouse him.
"This better be good," he growled.
"Good morning, Matthew. Sleep well?"
"Fine, Father. Why the hell are you calling me?"
"Watch your language, son. Look. I'm on the road headed for Texas, traveling with a man named Travis Boyette, a nice gentleman who visited our church last Sunday. You may have seen him. Walks with a cane. Anyway, Travis here has a confession to make to the authorities in Texas, a small town called Sloan, and we're dashing off to stop an execution." Matthew's voice cleared quickly.
"Have you lost your mind, Keith? You've got that guy in the car?"
"Oh, yes. Left Topeka about an hour ago. The reason I'm calling, Matt, is to ask for your help."
"I'll give you some help, Keith. Free advice. Turn that damn car around and get back here."
"Thanks, Matt, but look, in a few hours I'll need you to make a couple of phone calls to Sloan, Texas. What does Dana say about this?"
"Fine, fine. I'll need you to call the police, the prosecutor, and maybe a defense lawyer. I'll be calling them too, Matt, but since you're a prosecutor, they might listen to you. Are you still in Kansas? Yes, I-35. Don't cross the state line, Keith, please. Well, that might make it rather difficult to get to Texas, don't you think? Don't cross the state line. Get some sleep. I'll call you back around 6 and we'll start working the phones, okay? Keith closed his phone, punched voicemail, and waited. 10 seconds later, it buzzed. Matthew was calling back. They were through Emporia and bearing down on Wichita. Nothing prompted the narrative. Perhaps Boyette was getting sleepy himself. Or maybe he was just bored. But the more he talked, the more Keith realized he was listening to the twisted autobiography of a dying man. One who knew no sense could be made of his life, but wanted to try anyway. Daryl's brother, we called him Uncle Chet, would take me fishing. That was what he told my parents. Never caught the first fish. Never wet the first hook. We'd go to his little house out in the country. Had a pond out back, and that's where all the fish were supposed to be. Never made it that far. He'd give me a cigarette, let me taste his beer. At first, I didn't know what he was doing. Had no idea. I was just a kid, 8 years old. I was too scared to move, to fight back. I remember how bad it hurt. He had all sorts of kiddie porn, magazines and movies, sick stuff he was generous enough to share with me. You cram all that garbage into the head of a little boy, before long he sort of accepts it. I thought, well, maybe this is what kids do. Maybe this is what adults do to kids. It looked legitimate and normal. He wasn't mean to me. In fact, he bought me ice cream and pizza. Anything I wanted. After each fishing trip, he would drive me home, and right before we'd get to my house, he'd get real serious, sort of mean and threatening. He'd tell me that it was important for me to keep our little secret. Some things are private. He kept a gun in his truck, a shiny pistol. Later, he'd show me how to use it. But at first, he'd take it out and place it on the seat, then explain that he loved his secrets, and if they were ever revealed, then he would be forced to hurt someone, even me. If I told anyone, he would be forced to kill me, and then kill whomever I told, and that included Daryl and my mother. It was very effective. I never told anyone. We kept fishing. I think my mother knew, but she had her own problems, primarily with the bottle. She was drunk most of the time, didn't sober up until much later, till it was too late for me. When I was about 10 or so, my uncle gave me some pot. We started smoking together. And some pills. Wasn't all bad. I thought I was pretty cool. A young punk smoking cigarettes and pot, drinking beer, watching porn. The other part was never pleasant, but it didn't last long. We were living in Springfield at the time, and one day my mother told me we had to move. My dad, her husband, whatever the hell he was, had found a job near Joplin, Missouri, where I was born. We packed in a hurry, loaded everything into a U-Haul, and fled in the middle of the night. I'm sure there was some unpaid rent involved. Probably a lot more than that. Bills, lawsuits, arrest warrants, indictments, who knows. Anyway, I woke up the next morning in a double-wide trailer. A nice one. Uncle Chet got left behind. I'm sure it broke his heart. He finally found us and showed up a month or so later. Asked me if I wanted to go fishing. I said no.
He had no place to take me, so he just hung around the house. Couldn't take his eyes off me. They were drinking, the adults, and before long they got into a fight over money. Uncle Chet left cussing. Never saw him again. But the damage was done. If I saw him now, I'd take a baseball bat and splatter his brains across 40 acres. I was one screwed up little boy, and I guess I've never gotten over it. Can I smoke?
No.
Then can we pull over for a minute so I can smoke?
Sure. A few miles down the road, they pulled into a rest stop and took a break. Keith's phone buzzed again. Another missed call from Matthew Burns. Boyette wandered away, last seen drifting into some woods behind the restrooms, a cloud of smoke trailing him. Keith was walking across the parking lot, back and forth, trying to pump the blood, with one eye on his passenger. When Boyette was out of sight, gone in the darkness, Keith wondered if he was gone for good. He was already tired of the trip, and if there was an escape at this point, who would care? Keith would drive back home, wonderfully alone in the car, and face the music with his wife and get an earful from Matthew. With some luck, no one would ever know about the aborted mission. Boyette would do what he'd always done, drift here and there until he either died or got himself arrested again. But what if he hurt someone? Would Keith share criminal responsibility? Minutes passed with no movement from the woods. A dozen 18-wheelers were parked together at one end of the parking lot, their generators humming as their drivers slept. Keith leaned on his car and waited. He'd lost his nerve, and he wanted to go home. He wanted Boyette to stay in the woods, to go deeper until there was no turning back, to simply disappear. Then he thought of Dante Drum. A puff of smoke wafted from the trees. His passenger had not escaped. Miles passed without a word. Boyette seemed content to forget his past, though minutes earlier he'd been gushing details. At the first hint of numbness, Keith plowed ahead. You were in Joplin? Uncle Chet had come and gone. The tick. 5, 10 seconds. Then,
yeah. We were living in a trailer out from town, a poor section. We were always in the poor section, but I remember being proud because we had a nice trailer. A rental, but I didn't know it then. Next to the trailer park, there was a little road, asphalt that ran for miles into the hills south of Joplin in Newton County. There were creeks and dells and dirt roads. It was a kid's paradise. We'd ride our bikes for hours along the trails, and no one could ever find us. Sometimes we'd steal beer and booze out of the trailer, or even out of a store, and dash off into the hills for a little party. One time a kid named Damien had a bag of pot he'd stolen from his big brother, and we got so stoned we couldn't stay on our bikes. And this is where Nicole is buried. Keith counted to 11 before Boyette said, I suppose she's somewhere in there. Not sure I can remember, to tell you the truth. I was pretty drunk, Pastor. I tried to remember, even tried to draw a map the other day, but it'll be difficult if we get that far.
Why did you bury her there?
Didn't want anybody to find her. It worked.
How do you know it worked? How do you know her body hasn't been found? You buried her 9 years ago. You've been in prison for the past 6 years away from the news.
Pastor, I assure you she has not been found.
Keith felt assured. He believed Boyette, and the fact that he believed so much from this hardened criminal was frustrating. He was wide awake as they approached Wichita. Boyette had retreated into his sad little shell. He rubbed his temples occasionally. You went to court when you were 12 years old, Keith asked.
The tick. Something like that. Yes, I was 12. I remember the judge making some comment about me being too young to launch a new career as a criminal. Little did he know.
What was the crime?
We broke into a store and loaded up all the stuff we could carry. Beer, cigarettes, candy, lunch meat, chips. Had a regular feast in the woods. Got drunk. No problem until somebody looked at the video. It was my first offense, so I got probation. My co-defendant was Eddie Stewart. He was 14, and it was not his first offense. They sent him to reform school, and I never saw him again. It was a rough neighborhood, and there was no shortage of bad boys. We were either making trouble or getting into trouble. Daryl yelled at me, but he came and went. My mother tried her best, but couldn't stop drinking. My brother got sent away when he was 15. Me? I was 13. You ever been inside a reform school, Pastor?
No.
Didn't think so. These are the kids nobody wants. Most are not bad kids, not when they first get there. They just didn't have a chance. My first stop was a place near St. Louis, and like all reform schools, it was nothing but a penitentiary for kids. I got the top bunk in a long room crowded with kids from the streets of St. Louis. The violence was brutal. There were never enough guards or supervisors. We went to class, but the education was a joke. You had to join a gang to survive. Someone looked at my file and saw where I'd been sexually abused, so I was an easy target for the guards. After 2 years of hell, I was released. Now, Pastor, what's a 15-year-old kid supposed to do when he's back on the streets after 2 years of torture? He actually looked at Keith as if he expected an answer. Keith kept his eyes straight ahead and shrugged. The juvenile justice system does nothing but cultivate career criminals. Society wants to lock us up and throw away the key, but society is too stupid to realize that we'll eventually get out. And when we get out, it ain't pretty. Take me. I'd like to think I wasn't a hopeless case when I went in at 13, but give me 2 years and nothing but violence, hate, beatings, abuse. Then society's got a problem when I walk out at 15. Prisons are hate factories, Pastor, and society wants more and more of them. It ain't working.
Are you blaming someone else for what happened to Nicole? Boyette exhaled and looked away. It was a heavy question, and he sagged under its weight. Finally, he said,
"You missed the whole point, Pastor. What I did was wrong, but I couldn't stop myself. Why couldn't I stop myself? Because of what I am. I wasn't born this way. I became a man with a lot of problems, not because of my DNA, but because of what society demanded. Lock 'em up. Punish the hell out of them. And if you make a few monsters along the way, too bad.
What about the other 50%?
And who might those be?
Half of all inmates paroled from prison stay out of trouble and are never arrested again. Boyette didn't appreciate this statistic. He reshifted his weight and fixated on the right side mirror. He withdrew into his shell and stopped talking. When they were south of Wichita, he fell asleep. The cell phone rang again at 3:40 a.m. It was Matthew Burns.
"Where are you, Keith?" he demanded.
"Get some sleep, Matthew. Sorry I bothered you."
"I'm having trouble sleeping. Where are you?"
"About 30 miles from the Oklahoma state line."
"Still got your buddy?"
"Oh, yes. He's sleeping now. Me, I just nap on and off."
"I've talked to Dana. She's upset, Keith.
I'm worried, too.
We think you're losing your mind.
Probably so. I'm touched. Relax, Matthew. I'm doing what's right, and I'll survive whatever happens. Right now, my thoughts are with Dante Drum. Don't cross the state line. I heard you the first time. Good. I just wanted to be on record as warning you more than once. I'm writing it down. Okay now, Keith, listen to me. We have no idea what might happen once you get to Sloan and your buddy there starts running his mouth. I'm assuming he'll attract cameras like roadkill attracts buzzards. Stay out of the picture, Keith. Keep your head low. Don't talk to any reporters. One of two things will definitely happen. Number one, the execution will take place as scheduled. If so, then you've done your best and it'll be time to scramble back home. Boyette has the option of staying there or catching a ride back. Doesn't really matter to you. Just get back home. There's a decent chance no one will know about your little adventure in Texas. The second scenario is that the execution will be stayed. If so, you've won, but don't celebrate. While the authorities grab Boyette, you sneak out of town and get back home. Either way, you gotta stay out of sight. Am I clear?
I think so.
Here's the question. Where do we go when we get to Sloan? The prosecutor, the police, the press, the defense attorney? Robbie Flack. He's the only one who might listen. The police and the prosecutor have no reason to listen to Boyette. They have their man. They're just waiting for the execution. Flack is the only one who might believe you, and he certainly appears capable of making a lot of noise. If Boyette tells a good story, then Flack will take care of the press.
That's what I thought. I'm planning on calling Flack at 6. I doubt if he's sleeping much.
Let's talk before we start making calls.
You got it.
And Keith, I still think you're crazy.
I don't doubt it, Matthew.
He put the phone in his pocket, and a few minutes later the Subaru left Kansas and entered Oklahoma. Keith was driving 80 miles an hour. He was also wearing his clerical collar, and he'd convinced himself that any decent trooper wouldn't ask too many questions of a man of God whose crime was nothing more than speeding. Chapter 17. The Drum family spent the night in a budget motel on the outskirts of Livingston, less than 4 miles by car from the Allen B. Polunsky Correctional Facility, where Dante had been locked up for over 7 years. The motel did a modest trade with the families of inmates, including the rather bizarre cult of death row wives from abroad. At any given time, around 20 condemned men were married to European women they could never actually touch. The weddings were not officially sanctioned by the state, but the couples nonetheless considered themselves married and carried on to the fullest extent possible. The wives corresponded with each other and often traveled together to Texas to see their men. They stayed at the same motel. Four had eaten at a table near the Drums late the night before. They were usually noticeable with their thick accents and suggestive clothing. They liked to be noticed. Back home, they were minor celebrities. Dante had rebuffed all offers of matrimony. During his final days, he turned down book deals, requests for interviews, marriage proposals, and the chance to make an appearance on Fordyce, hitting hard. He'd refused to meet with both the prison chaplain and his own minister, the Reverend Johnny Canty. Dante had given up on religion. He wanted no part of the same God so fervently worshipped by the devout Christians who were hell-bent on killing him. Roberta Drum awoke in the darkness of room 109. She had slept so little in the past month that her fatigue now kept her awake. The doctor had given her some pills, but they had backfired and made her edgy. The room was warm, and she pulled back the sheets. Her daughter Andrea was in the other twin bed, only a few feet away, and seemed to be sleeping. Her sons Cedric and Marvin were next door. The rules of the prison allowed them to visit with Dante from 8 a.m. until noon on this, his final day. After their last farewell, he would be transported to the death chamber at the prison in Huntsville. 8 in the morning was hours away. The schedule was fixed, all movements dictated by a system famous for its efficiency. At 5 o'clock that afternoon, the family would report to a prison office in Huntsville and then take a short ride in a van to the death chamber, where they would be herded into a cramped witness room just seconds before the drugs were administered. They would see him on the gurney, tubes already in his arms, listen to his final words, wait 10 minutes or so for the official declaration of death, then leave quickly. From there, they would drive to a local funeral home to retrieve the body and take it home. Could it be a dream? A nightmare? Was she really there, awake in the darkness, contemplating her son's final hours? Of course she was. She'd lived the nightmare for 9 years now, ever since the day she'd been told that Dante had not only been arrested, but also confessed. The nightmare was a book as thick as her Bible, every chapter another tragedy, every page filled with sorrow and disbelief. Andrea rolled from one side to another, the cheap bed squeaking and rattling. Then she was still and breathing heavily. For Roberta, one horror had been replaced by the next. The numbing shock of seeing her boy in jail for the first time, in an orange jumpsuit, eyes wild and scared. The ache in her stomach as she thought about him in jail, locked away from his family and surrounded by criminals. The hope of a fair trial only to suffer the shock of realizing it was anything but fair. Her loud and unrestrained sobbing when the death sentence was announced. The last image of her son being led from the courtroom by thick deputies so smug in their work. The endless appeals and fading hopes. The countless visits to death row where she watched a strong, healthy young man slowly deteriorate. She lost friends along the way, and she really didn't care. Some were skeptical of the claims of innocence. Some grew weary of all the talk about her son. But she was consumed and had little else to say. How could anyone else know what a mother was going through? And the nightmare would never end. Not today, when Texas finally executed him. Not next week, when she buried him. Not at some point in the future when the truth was finally known, if ever. The horrors add up, and there were many days when Roberta Drum doubted she had the strength to get out of bed. She was so tired of pretending to be strong. "Are you awake, Mama?" Andrea asked softly. "You know I am, honey." "Did you sleep any?" "No. I don't think so." Andrea kicked off the sheets and stretched her legs. The room was very dark with no light filtering in from the outside. "It's 4:30, Mama." "I can't see. My watch glows in the dark." Andrea was the only one of the Drum kids with a college degree. She taught kindergarten in a town near Sloan. She had a husband, and she wanted to be at home in her bed, far away from Livingston, Texas. She closed her eyes in an effort to fall asleep, but only seconds passed before she was staring at the ceiling. "Mama, I gotta tell you something."
"What is it, honey?"
"I've never told anyone this, and I never will. It's a burden I've carried a long, long time, and I want you to know it before they take Dante."
"I'm listening."
"It was a time after the trial, after they'd sent him away, that I began to doubt his story. I think I was looking for a reason to doubt him. What they said sort of made sense. I could see Dante fooling around with that girl, afraid of getting caught, and I could see her trying to break up and him not wanting to. Maybe he sneaked out of the house that night when I was asleep. And when I heard his confession in court, I have to admit it made me uneasy. They never found her body. And if he threw her in the river, then maybe that's why they'll never find her. I was trying to make sense out of everything that had happened. I wanted to believe that the system is not totally broken. So I convinced myself that he was probably guilty.
that they probably got the right man. I kept writing to him, kept coming over here to see him and all, but I was convinced he was guilty. For a while, it made me feel better in some strange way. This went on for months, maybe a year.
What changed your mind?
Robbie, you remember that time we went to Austin to hear the case on direct appeal?
Indeed I do.
It was a year or so after the trial.
I was there, honey.
We were sitting in that big courtroom, looking at those 9 judges, all white, all looking so important in their black robes and hard frowns, their airs. And across the room was Nicole's family and her big-mouthed mother, and Robbie got up to argue for us. He was so good. He went through the trial and pointed out how weak the evidence was. He mocked the prosecutor and the judge. He was afraid of nothing. He attacked the confession, and he brought up for the first time the fact that the police had not told him about the anonymous phone caller who said it was Dante. That shocked me. How could the police and the prosecutor withhold evidence? Didn't bother the court, though. I remember watching Robbie argue so passionately, and it dawned on me that he, the lawyer, the white guy from the rich part of town, had no doubt whatsoever that my brother was innocent. And I believed him right then and there. I felt so ashamed for doubting Dante.
It's okay, honey.
Please don't tell anyone.
Never. You can trust your mother, you know.
They sat up and moved to the edges of their beds, holding hands, foreheads touching. Andrea said,
"You want to cry or you want to pray?"
"We can pray later. But we can't cry later."
"Right. Let's have us a good cry."
The pre-dawn traffic picked up as they approached Oklahoma City. Boyette's forehead was pressed against the passenger's window, his mouth open in a pathetic drool. His nap was entering its second hour, and Keith was happy with the solitude. He'd stopped back near the state line for a cup of carry-out coffee, a dreadful machine brew that he would normally pour into a ditch. But what it lacked in flavor, it more than made up for in caffeine, and Keith was buzzing right along, his head spinning, his speedometer exactly 8 miles per hour over the limit. Boyette had requested a beer at the last stop. Keith declined and bought him a bottle of water. He found a bluegrass station out of Edmond and listened to it at low volume. At 5:30 he called Dana, but she had little to say. South of Oklahoma City, Boyette jerked from his slumber and said,
"Guess I dozed off."
"You did indeed."
"Pastor, these pills I take really work on the bladder. Can we do a quick pit stop?"
"Sure," Keith said. What else could he say? He kept one eye on the clock. They would leave the expressway somewhere north of Denton, Texas, and head east on 2-lane roads. Keith had no idea how long that would take. His best guess was arriving in Sloan between noon and 1 p.m. The pit stops, of course, were not helping their progress. They stopped in Norman and bought more coffee and water. Boyette managed to blaze through 2 cigarettes, sucking and blowing rapidly as if it might be his last smoke, while Keith quickly refueled. 15 minutes later, they were back on I-35, racing south through the flat country of Oklahoma. As a man of God, Keith felt compelled to at least explore the subject of faith. He began, somewhat tentatively, "You've talked about your childhood, Travis, and we don't need to go back there. Just curious, though. If you were ever exposed to church or to a preacher when you were a kid..." The tick was back. So was the contemplation.
"No," he said, and for a moment that seemed to be all. Then,
"I never knew my mother to go to church. She didn't have much of a family. I think they were ashamed of her, so they kept away. Daryl certainly didn't do the church thing. Uncle Chet needed a good dose of religion, but I'm sure he's in hell right now.
Keith saw an opening. So you believe in hell?
I suppose. I believe we all go somewhere after we die. And I can't imagine you and me going to the same place. Can you, Pastor? I mean, look, I've spent most of my life in prison, and trust me, there's a species of mankind that's subhuman. These people were born mean. They're vicious, soulless, crazy men who cannot be helped. When they die, they gotta go to some bad place.
The irony was almost comical. A confessed murderer and serial rapist condemning violent men. Was there a Bible in the house? Keith asked, trying to stay away from the subject of heinous crimes.
Never saw one. Never saw much in the way of books. I was raised on porn, Pastor, fed to me by Uncle Chet and kept under Daryl's bed. That's the extent of my childhood reading.
Do you believe in God?
Look, Pastor, I'm not talking about God and Jesus and salvation and all that. I heard it all the time in prison. Lots of guys get really turned on when they're locked away and start thumping the Bible. I guess some are serious, but it also sounds good at the parole hearings. I just never bought into it.
Are you prepared for death, Travis? A pause.
Look, Pastor, I'm 44 years old and my life has been one massive train wreck. I'm tired of living in prison. I'm tired of living with the guilt of what I'd done. I'm tired of hearing the pitiful voices of the people I hurt. I'm tired of a lot of shit, Pastor, okay? Sorry for the language. I'm tired of being some degenerate who lives on the edges of society. I'm just so sick of it all. I'm proud of my tumor, okay? Hard to believe, but when it's not cracking my skull, I kinda like the damn thing. It tells me what's ahead. My days are numbered, and that doesn't bother me. I won't hurt anybody else. No one will miss me, Pastor. If I didn't have the tumor, I'd get a bottle of pills and a bottle of vodka and float away forever. Still might do that.
So much for a penetrating discussion.